It doesn't back up.
Yeah.
I also have a tendency to talk fast. I'll try to slow down.
Oh, no.
I grew up out here all my life, and I don't know why I talk so fast. It doesn't sound fast to me, but... Your volume's down now.
Yeah, that ought to do it. Okay. Let's just see if that works. Oh, I think we're fine.
Hello?
Yeah. Why don't you just say your...
My name is Ernie Bergman. I was born in 1948 in San Francisco, and my parents moved to Mill Valley in 1949, to Tam Valley, and we lived there for about 4.5 years. I went to kindergarten at Tallapas Valley School, and then we moved uptown in 1954 to Blytheville Canyon, Coromandel Avenue, and that's where we stayed for 25 years.
Huh. What did your parents do?
My father was a sea captain. Very rarely saw him. He was from Sweden, from Stockholm, Sweden, and he was out to sea probably 10 months out of the year. And so he only came home twice a year. So my mother basically raised my sister and me. And there's only one sister. She's 2.5 years older. My mother was a nurse. And for a while she did private duty and worked at Grand General. And then for the longest time she taught nursing over in the city. Mm-hmm. She died in 1973. My dad died in 1977.
Yeah.
My mom was 58. My dad was 77. There was 15 years difference between the two of them. Mm-hmm. But my mother's from Iowa, good German stock. And... I loved growing up in Mill Valley. It was one of the greatest things I could ever imagine, is being able to be here. Not only the best place in the world anyway, but just in the 50s, we were all just kids. We didn't pay attention to money, and I didn't even know if there was a lot here. We knew where everybody lived. We could ride our bikes to school. We didn't hitchhike, but we'd stay out, not worry about being kidnapped, or everybody left their front doors open and the keys in the car, and everybody knew everybody, and, you know, it was just a great place to grow up. As probably in the 50s, most places were. It's before all the crazy stuff started happening.
Yeah. What was downtown like?
I guess I was the IJ paperboy, independent journal paperboy down there, so I knew all the store owners, but it was a fun place. The places that I remember probably the most was there was an ice cream parlor called Espasti's, and that got bought out and became La Ginestra. It's been an Italian restaurant ever since, but originally it was an ice cream store. very familiar was Men's Mayors. On the corner where that coffee shop is and the dog place, that was a department store, a 2 or 3 story called Mayer's, and that's where the women and the jewelry and all the stuff was. And then where it's Delecchio's, the restaurant, just down on Miller Avenue. Delecchio, something. Anyway, it's where Sweetwater's going in, about 2 doors away. That was Men's Mayer's.
D'Angelo's.
Mm-hmm. D'Angelo's was Men's Mayer's. And that's where all the men's stuff was, and that's where I got all my Cub Scout stuff. So, I mean, there were certain places for all the kids in the entire city where you got certain stuff. And Men's Mayors was where you bought your Cub Scout and Boy Scout stuff. And Varney's Hardware, which is where Banana Republic is now. Jack Varney was an old family name around here. That's where you bought your chains and rings when you went steady in the second grade, or you went in and got nails or stuff for your models or whatever. Mill Valley Records was... just right next to the Sequoia Theater, the famous one. It used to be next to the theater, and that's where you bought your 45s. And every Saturday afternoon, we all went to Sequoia Theater for the matinees. And we went in there for 25 cents. Mm-hmm. For 25 cents, you'd get in, plus get a Coke and a candy bar. And all the kids sat down below, up in the loge. That was the adult and the smoking section, so no kids could go up there. But we were all down there at the bottom, and a guy named Mr. Gilmore, who was the manager, used to bring kids up whose birthday it was, and we'd throw stuff on the screen, and it was always a bunch of cartoons, and then it was science fiction stuff, or horror stories, like The Tingler and Vincent Price kind of movies, mm-hmm. or it was a lot of Three Stooges and stuff like that. But every Saturday, if you didn't show up at the movie theater, you just weren't in it. But it was just a great, great time. And restaurants, La Petite, I mean, I didn't go as a kid, but my parents, my mom might bring it there, was... right where the Mill Valley Hotel is now. That was a great, great little kind of restaurant. Where Sweetwater was Dowd's. It was a furniture place. You know, there's just a lot of different places around town that we had a lot of fun with. And, of course, Little League was a big deal, and that was in Boyle Park.
It must have helped your mother a lot since your father was away. You said 10 months of the year.
Yeah, pretty much.
To have an extended family of sorts.
My sister and I call ourselves the original Latchkey Kids, because many times we had to make our own dinner, or we showed up at our friend's parents' house, and they kind of took care of us until Mom got home. Because sometimes, She either had to work late or she had too much stuff to do or, you know, our schedule was different than hers. Mm-hmm. And then when we came old enough, I was playing football at TAM and playing a lot of sports and or even in Little League, and we always had something to do after school. So it I mean, we didn't know any different. So that's just how it was for us, is that a lot of times we had to take care of ourselves.
And what house did you live on? Where was
it? 222 Cormier Avenue. Beautiful place. They've remodeled it since. But the house I grew up in was built in 1903. It was a big old two-story shingled house. Because my father was from Sweden, we painted it red with a green roof, because that's Swedish. It sat on a third of an acre of land with a creek going through the backyard. Mm-hmm. It had 33 redwoods on the property with a big circular driveway. So it was a beautiful place. Yeah. When we first bought it, the land right behind us was just one big field with apple trees in it. And my parents bought our house for $14,000. And they could have bought the land behind there, too, on the other side of the creek for $1,000 more, but they couldn't afford that, or chose not to afford it. And so that went and got developed later. My house that I grew up in, Tears, goes sold for $2.6 million. So, obviously, Miller Real Estate's been a pretty good investment for people that stuck around for a long time.
Yeah.
But it was nice when the Cormier Avenue was, when we first moved there, it was two-way. And my mother hated that because if you know Cormier Avenue, just as you're turning the last right-hand turn to go downtown, it's like less than one lane. Mm-hmm. And if a car was coming up, the person going down had to back all the way up. It used to drive my mother crazy. Mm-hmm. So she went out and got a petition to get the thing changed to one-way. She wanted it one-way coming up. Mm-hmm. But this, I guess she didn't tell the city council that. They made it one-way going down. But anyway, the reason it's one-way is because of my mother.
Oh,
and, you know, because I delivered... it's not a big deal. Because... I deliver the paper downtown, and I also deliver the paper all the way up Blytheville Canyon. So I knew every household all the way up Blytheville Avenue, mm-hmm. West Blytheville, and also Cormier Avenue, too. So, I mean, you know, all the families knew me, and I knew all the families.
How were the tips?
Terrible. And I was a lousy mathematician, too. the paper was $1.50 a month. And if somebody gave me $5, I'd give them $4.50 back. You know, so obviously I wasn't very good at that. Until somebody told me, and then I finally started actually making money.
Uh-huh. Did you read the paper, too?
I don't. I'm sure I did. I don't remember reading a lot when I was really young, although I read Hardy Boys all the time. Mm-hmm. There were a couple bookstores in town. I read two things when I was young. I read Superman comic books, which I was addicted to, and Hardy Boys books. Mm-hmm. And the Superman comic books were a dime. Hardy Boys were, I think, $1 a piece. Anytime there was a new issue coming out, whatever, I would run and do some work or borrow some money or something, and I'd sit down at the bus depot and I'd read Superman comic books and I'd go up to the bookstore and buy a Hardy Boy book. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of reading, but it wasn't, you know, necessarily current events. It was just a lot of fun.
Yeah. And where was your mother a nurse?
Marin General. She also was one of the founders of the RN program at College of Marin. Oh. And then when she was teaching, which she did the last 15 years of her life, I guess, she taught at a Galileo adult school in the city. On Bay Street, Pan Van Ness. But she was from Iowa. She had a master's degree and very smart woman and, you know, really enjoyed what she was doing too, although she did it by necessity. But, you know, she was real good at what she did.
How did she and your father meet?
interesting question. During World War II in October of 1944, my mother was teaching nursing at, I think it was University of Washington up in Seattle. And one night, during the war, she and her girlfriend, actually it was Marcia Badan, I think, decided to go out on the town and get a beer. And coincidentally, that same night, my father was a sea captain during World War II, and he and one of his buddies decided they were going to go out in the town and have a beer. So they met at some bar somewhere, and I guess drawing to the end of the evening, my dad said, well, you know, this bar is closing, but I belong to some private clubs, but I can only bring one guest. And so, you know, he didn't really know who to pick, so... My dad, I guess either my mother or my father, they said, well, let's flip a coin. And I don't know whether my mom won or lost, but she went to the club with my dad. And then actually, probably the next day or the day after, I think he had to go back out to sea. But they wrote incessantly, both very intelligent people, and my dad decided to ask her to marry him, so she flew out to San Francisco. And they got married October 30th, 1944. Oh. Another coincidence about that is my mother had four brothers from Iowa. And one was a B-17 pilot in Europe, and one was in the Navy, a dentist, And Fred, her brother, was in the Army, and I forget the others. But when my father was coming back to San Francisco, they stopped off in Hawaii. And they had a couple of days there, which most of the ships weren't. He was Merchant Marine, not Navy. Anyway, he's sitting in the Officers Club in Hawaii, and they sit at the bar, and he starts talking to this Navy guy. And he says, well, where are you going? He said, well, I'm going to San Francisco. So what are you going there for? I'm going to get married. It turned out it was my uncle, Cap, her brother, who was going to San Francisco also to go to the wedding. So my father and my uncle totally coincidentally met in Hawaii just before the wedding. So I guess it must have been meant to be.
Oh, that gave me goosebumps.
Yeah, it's really kind of a funny story.
So tell me, if you don't mind, could you give me a chronology from being the paper boy to going to TAM, to going to Vietnam, to coming back to TAM to teach those
guys? Pretty tall order.
Yeah, I know.
Moved uptown when I was 5, went to Old Mill School. Met a lot of great people who I still know. Most of those are still my good friends. There were about 5 or 6 elementary schools at that time. There was Old Mill, Park, Homestead, Tallapass Valley. I don't even know if Strawberry existed yet. Maybe it did, but I never knew what was going on the other side of the highway anyway. Mm-hmm. There were about 3 schools in Sausalito. But the ones I was most familiar with was Park, because they were kind of our rival. And so I went there for 6 years, for 1 through 6. And then went to Ed McGuire, which was 7th and 8th. That was the only, we called it junior high school at the time. And that's really where we met the rest of the kids, because when we were at our own elementary schools, we didn't really travel that far away, except for maybe Little League. But Ed McGuire is when we actually had to sit in the same classroom and kind of create a lot of friendships that would go on to high school. Mm-hmm. 2 years there, and then I started TAM in 62. My sister started there in 59, I guess, and she was 2.5 years older than me. But had a great time at TAM, graduated in 66, played a lot of sports, played football. I was a 3-year letterman for varsity. I was a cheerleader. I've always been very social, so I did a lot of stuff. In fact, when I graduated from high school, I was voted, you know, they had the senior polls. Mm-hmm. I was voted biggest flirt, most friendly, biggest clown, and most unforgettable, or something like that. Oh. I had all 4 of those things. But, It was a great time to live. I mean, in the late 50s, early 60s, it was just, I really think that my class in 66 was the last kind of old-fashioned conservative class before the drugs came in and all the hippie stuff and all the disobedience and all the changes in society. My class was the last class that did not step on the lawn and did student government and had meat theater and was, you know, had pretty traditional values.
Mm-hmm. And was it pretty much all white, or were the kids there from
their
own city?
We were the only high school that was integrated. There was one black kid who lived in Terra Linda who went to school there, probably from Hamilton Air Force Base. Otherwise, TAM was the only school that had black kids. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because, especially with sports, a lot of the white kids from other schools, you know, they were afraid of them. They didn't know any black kids, so they didn't know how to deal with it. And occasionally, if I knew some kids from other schools, they'd say, well, how do you play sports with those guys or whatever. We didn't know any difference. They were our friends. Mm-hmm. You know, so some of my best friends still are kids I met in high school that were from Marin City. Mm-hmm. I see. But I guess the things that are familiar in my mind is on Saturdays when we all went to the show, the black kids would show up on the Greyhound bus because that was the bus depot right down there. And they'd go to the show and they'd all sit in one section by themselves, which hadn't surely changed that much. And then at the end of the show, they'd all trope back down the bus depot and go back to Marin City. And, you know, we really didn't have a lot of contact with them because they all pretty much stuck to themselves, and we did too. I remember at the end of school, unless you were playing sports, the black kids were always hitchhiking in front of Tallapass to get back to Marin City, or they were taking the bus. White kids would go that way, and the black kids would go that way. Mm-hmm. So our socialization was really only when we were at school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, weekends, and, you know, except for some of my friends, my personal friends, who, you know, had the guts to come uptown. There was only one black family that lived in Mill Valley during that time, and that was Dr. Collins, and he had 2 or 3 sons. And I knew both the sons, too, Chuck mm-hmm. Collins and I forget the older brother's name, but Chuck and I were friends, at least acquaintances, but we knew each other pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And when was the wedding in Marin City that you mentioned?
Oh, 1980.
Oh.
Yeah, Horace White. It was about 450 people showed up at his funeral. He died in 82. No, he died in, I'm sorry, 2000. I'm getting all messed up here. The wedding was in 2000. He died in 2001.
Uh-huh. So you said you were telling me earlier before we started recording about going to Marin City and not ever having really been inside it.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally, if some of the white guys who had cars were going that way and one of the black guys would ask, hey, can I have a ride home? Sure, come on in. But, of course, we would be very careful to drop them off right at front and never go inside because we were afraid to. And so I think I remember one or two times we ever went any further in than where the bus depot was on the corner. And they used to have a sheriff station there, too. But it was always kind of funny. The black kids would make fun of it because we were friends. And there was one guy, Henry Garrison. His name was Ripsaw. Everybody had a nickname. And I remember one day we were driving him back down there. And he says, well, back to Hershey Hill. I mean, that's what he called it. And, of course, we were all freaked out. We didn't know how to respond to that. But there was those little play bantering back and forth when we were growing up. But now we never went inside. There was really no socialization at all in Marin City because we were afraid.
And there was no interracial dating either, though, either.
Minimally. Mm-hmm. There was a senior, my sister's class, a guy named Art Foster, who was going out with a woman, Margaret, I forget her last name. And that was, and he was very black, and she was very white, and he was a star athlete, and also a wonderful guy, Margaret Conger. And they're still married, but they dated, and that was probably the only one that I'm aware of. And I know one of my best friends, Nora Mortman, who grew up on Manor, was very, very much taken with a woman named Jerry Denard, and she was black. And they used to stand together at school, but I don't think they ever went out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, it was, you know, socially still pretty separate even at school. But, you know, we, like I said, by playing sports and all that, we were friends. It was always funny then. I can remember maybe four or five, maybe not even that many, maybe three major fights the whole time I was at TAM. And the paper would always call my race riot. You know, there was a race riot in Mill Valley, and a race riot down at TAM. They weren't race riots. They were the black hoodlums versus the white hoodlums. You know, the jocks never got involved. We were all student government. We were all friends. It was just the back parking lot crowd above the blacks and whites that were fighting. But paper was called a race riot. We knew it wasn't, but that's kind of how it was portrayed. Hmm. Am I talking too fast, by the way?
No. Well, you know, the transcriber will.
Yeah.
She's experienced, and she can also slow it down.
Yeah, good.
So in your senior year of high school, what were you thinking of doing for a career?
Well, probably ever since I was a freshman, I wanted to go to Annapolis. But I never had the confidence, and I never thought I had the brains. And I wasn't a good studier. You know, I was a B-minus, C-plus student, but I never studied. I played most of the time. I always had too many things to do besides homework. So I got by just on my natural abilities, although I never had any confidence in those either. I don't want to get too involved with this, but my mother, my entire life, always told me I'd never amount to anything. And I believed her.
Your mother told you
this? Oh, yeah, yeah. My mother used to say things like that I was a late bloomer. Or, well, at least he can play football, because she really had nothing else. And that was really kind of a competition between my uncle and her. But it all came down on us. When I went to service, she used to tell her friends, well, we didn't know what to do with them, so we put them in the Navy. You know, just stuff like that. So I never had a lot of confidence to do anything. And so when I was a junior and senior, I was pretty apolitical. My mother and father were almost John Birchers. They were very right-wing, very conservative. And my mother used to say, well, the only reason we're not John Birchers, we never got around to joining. I mean, very conservative. I remember when I was a kid, pardon me, in 1952, in Tam Valley, stuffing mailboxes with I Like Ike things. You know, going around with her, because she was part of the Republican Party, and my dad was too. But for me, I mean, I was always that way just because they were my parents, not as conservative as them. But as far as Vietnam goes, I could care less. You know, for me, going in the service was an escape. It was just a big adventure, and it meant getting out of the house. When I was a senior in high school, I didn't really have any study habits. I wasn't mature enough to go to college. I had no motivation to go to college. My mother would tell me, again, my sister and my entire life, if you don't go to college, you'll never amount to anything. You know, she'd tell us that all the time. So I knew I had to go to college and had to finish, but I, you know, otherwise I'd never amount to anything. But I just was not ready. So one day, a really good friend of mine, Bob Rogers, who lives in Tiburon right now, he and I just talked. He says, well, let's join the Navy. I actually wanted to go in the Marines first or be an Army Special Forces. My father, being Merchant Marine, said, you go in the Navy. And I think my parents thought that was the best thing for me because they didn't know what else to do with me. And that really didn't have any, well, it had an emotional effect on me, but it didn't, not necessarily what I wanted to do. So one day after school, Bob Roger and I said, well, let's go up to the recruiter and join the Navy. You know, get it over with. One thing I like to stress when I'm lecturing to kids in college, kids in high school, going in the service was part of the deal. It was expected of us. It wasn't good, bad, or indifferent. Going in the service was something you did, and it was part of growing up, and it was part of the process of becoming an adult. So the prospect of going in the service had no really negative impact at all. It was just a matter of time when you did it. And so when Bob and I were talking after school one day, I said, well, let's go up and get it over with, you know. We're not ready to go to school, college. We don't have any money anyway. Let's join the Navy. So we jumped in his Volkswagen, and as we were leaving the parking lot, another really good friend of mine, Barry Warnock, who lives up in Oroville, and I says, hey, can I get a ride home from school? Said, yeah, no problem, but we're going to the Navy recruiter first. So we jumped in the back, and he ended up joining too. He's ever forgiven me, but we went in on the buddy system, and I had been picked for the, back then they had an all-star football game at the end of summer between North and South Marin, and I was picked for the South team. I was an all-star. And I wanted to play in this game because I loved football, and it was, you know, probably my last game. So we were able to get a 120-day deferred program, which they had, where we joined on May 2nd, didn't have to show up for activity until September 2nd. So May 2nd, I raised my hand. We went over to the AFES for the physical. So I was undraftable at the time, you know, because I'd already joined. So I was already going in. So, but I looked at it as just one exciting adventure. I could not wait to go in the service. Now, it's interesting. I went in the service because I had to get out of the house. I had no desire to go to college. I had no study habits. 1.5 hour in boot camp, God, I wanted to go to college. You know, but I had to wait 4 years to be able to do it. I remember standing there at 4 o'clock in the morning with some guy yelling at me and standing at attention, and I didn't know how to do that. And I thought, what did I do to myself? But it all worked out okay.
Did you know you'd be going to Vietnam?
No, and I didn't care. Vietnam, like I said, was not a focus of mine at all. Mm-hmm. It was part of the deal. I mean, I really didn't. If I went, maybe that's more of an adventure. If I thought about it, I probably did. It was probably made it even more exciting in a war because I was a big John Wayne fan and I believed all the stuff that you saw on TV and all that. Mm-hmm. But it had no negative impact on me at all. I may have had some apprehension, but it wouldn't be anything that would have stopped me from going in or following orders.
Did your father or mother give you any advice before you?
My dad gave me the, I think, some of the usual. He retired in 1965, so he was with me for 1 year of school before I went to service. And he and I still never talked, but I remember in the service, because he had spent most of his time in Asia, and he figured that's where I was going too. He worked Japan and China. And I remember when he was in the early 60s, he used to talk about South Indochina. Or French Indochina. And never had I thought that that's where I'm going to be too. But I grew up with all kinds of Asian artifacts and bric-a-brac in the house. And when we were kids, he'd bring us back all the Japanese wind-up toys and, you know, the dolls and all that stuff. So I was real familiar with that. But it's interesting. When I was overseas and when I was experiencing pretty much the same thing my father had experienced when he was, you know, active duty, that's when he started writing me. And we actually started talking because he found a frame of reference for me. And when I was in Manila or when I was in Japan, because I was home boarded in Yokosuka, Japan, I never spent any time there. I mean, somewhat. I was mostly in Vietnam. But I started getting letters from him talking about his experiences and watch out for this. And I have friends here. And I was over here, too. And they were all very interesting letters. But then when I got home and got out of the service, we quit talking. So just that little four-year period was when he and I communicated the most.
How strange.
Well, I was born when he was 48. He was the captain of his ship. He really didn't know how to be around kids. And because my mother ran the show 90% of the time, a lot of times my sister and I couldn't wait for him to be home, but when he got there, we couldn't wait for him to leave because we was into the hell out of his authoritarianism and his conflict with my mother and et cetera, et cetera. So I never really had a relationship with him. Oh. Except for when I was in the service. And of course, then we were 10,000 miles apart, so it was only by letter.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting.
But the way the service works is you go through boot camp and you take all these examinations, basically IQ tests. And for the most part, most people go directly to the infantry in the Army, or they go to what they call deck force in the Navy. That's where you basically learn the skills of being a sailor, and you chip a lot of paint and swab a lot of decks, and you shoot a lot of guns and all that. Well, I'd scored high enough on my tests, amazingly, and where I qualified for a special school. And they have you fill out dream sheets. And they teach you about all the different jobs you can have in the Navy. So I put four of them down. And it just coincidentally, when I was getting out of boot camp, one of the schools that was on my dream sheet was opening up at the same time. So I didn't go directly out to the fleet. I went to one of these schools. My specialty was celestial navigation. So, I mean, even though I flunked math twice in high school, I was out there doing calculus and all this kind of stuff and not even knowing it.
Wow.
And that's always been weird about me. I have a mental block against certain things, but if I'm doing it practically, I pick it up. Like, I was an accounting major in college, but I flunked business math because I'd never been good at all these formulas. But for me, accounting was debit, credit. No big deal. Figure that out. When I was doing celestial navigation, I was working with these huge publications and doing this and logarithms and all that, but that's not the way it was explained to me. I learned how to do it and what it meant, but not why necessarily, although I know why. But so my specialty was selection navigation. Anyway, getting off the point.
Where was the school?
In San Diego, at 32nd Street Station, San Diego. I went to boot camp at San Diego also.
And then from there you went to Japan, and from there to Vietnam?
Well, I was going to mention, when my school ended, I didn't have orders yet. I had no idea where I was going. Mm-hmm. And so I was sent, after school, I was sent to Treasure Island. Home, all of a sudden stationed right next to my house, so I went home every night for 7 days. This was in February of 1967. And all of a sudden, I got orders, and so I had to get up to Travis and jump on a plane. They bussed me up there. But I was not allowed to open up my orders until I arrived at the airport. I arrived at Travis Air Force Base, I guess, for some secret thing. And my orders said I didn't even know where I was going. And when I opened up my plane ticket, I was going to the Philippines. And I called my parents up right away. I'm going to the Philippines. And then they said, well, I know you're going to Vietnam because that's where you... But I was so excited to think, Philippines, wow, what an adventure. This is, I can't wait. And I flew over civilian on February 15th, 1967. I got aboard a Continental or some kind of plane. we flew from Travis Air Force Base to Hawaii, refuel, to Wake Island to refuel, and then to Angeles City in the Philippines, Clark Air Force Base, and then took a three-hour bus ride, which was amazing. I mean, talking about culture shock. Going from American, being just some stupid kid who grew up in the Mill Valley, and now I'm going through and I'm seeing little villages and grass houses and people cooking monkey meat on the side of the road and barbecues and smelling the smells and seeing water buffalo and all that. And I took a three-hour ride from Angeles City to Subic Bay, which is a huge Navy base there, and Longapo City, and went to the transit barracks and basically was waiting for my ship, which was in Vietnam. And my ship was involved at the time. You know, my ultimate destination was a ship called the Windham County. It was a very small LST, landing ship tank, which basically is an amphibious ship that used to do landings and support and riverine stuff. And I mean, usually you think about the Navy as being the destroyers and the aircraft carriers. Well, I was on one of these amphibious ship that carried troops. And you know, when you see movies of D-Day and they go right up the beach, and well, that's what this thing did. So we were not Yankee Station, so to speak. We were not. Some of the ships that went to Vietnam never saw land. They were 50 miles off. We were in country primarily, especially in 68 when I was in the Riverine Force. But anyway, I spent 2 months. Because of the dateline, I got to the Philippines on February 17th, 1967. I was driven to Subic Bay. I checked in the transit barracks there. 2 days later, I was actually chosen to work at a whole different destination, which is the best thing that could happen to me, because the transit barracks, which is for everybody who was in transit going to their station but not quite, that's where they stayed. Transit barracks in the Philippines had a terrible reputation. There was a masochist who ran the thing. And I was taken out of there after 2 days and brought to some of the just pure luck. And so I had a great time in the PI. I was 18 years old. I'd never had any experience dating because I was very, very insecure in high school. Subic Bay was an open port. During the war, and probably now too, when you go to what we call a Liberty Port, one of the towns that people go to, The townsfolk provide exactly what military guys want, women and alcohol. And so you walk out the front gate in the Longapo City, and you look down the street, Magsaysay Street, and you'll find probably 1,000 bars on either side of the street, and probably 10 times that prostitutes. And that was my introduction to adult life when I was 18 years old. Is, you know, basically all you could drink, all you wanted, and as many women as you wanted. Of course, it always cost you $5, but, you know, that's how a lot of kids my age became adults, so to speak, is by going in the service and going overseas and having absolutely no restrictions on it whatsoever.
Wow.
So I was there for from February 17th until, and I was an E2. That's like almost as low as you can be. I had no rank, no authority whatsoever, except I looked up by going to this separate barracks. And then basically I was sitting around for orders. My ship was involved in a major combat operation in, Chulai, marine operation, just south of Da Nang. And what they would do is they'd try to find openings where they could get to the unit, and then that's where when I would get orders. 2 months. And they were so involved, and it was so dangerous, they couldn't fly me over. So I stayed in the PI for about 2.5 months. Then April, my 19th birthday was March 31st of 67. The 2 days later, I got orders finally, April 3rd, to go to Da Nang, Vietnam, which was also scary, but also very exciting, too. And so 4 days after my 19th birthday, I flew to Vietnam, to Da Nang.
Do you remember your first sight of it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was a military plane. We flew out from QB Airport, QB Point Air Base in the Philippines there. We landed at 1 o'clock in the morning, so I didn't really see sights. I just saw some lights. But because we left a Liberty port, I was dressed in very, very bright tropical white uniform. Summertime, April. Actually, PIZO is summertime. We got there at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was scary, but, you know, it was exciting, too. They opened up the door. We were in an air-conditioned cabin. They opened up the door, and when I walked out the door, the heat, and you've seen this on movies probably, the heat was so intense it almost threw me back. My first experience in Vietnam was 1 o'clock in the morning, smelling the heat, smelling incense, smelling JP-5 fuel, smelling manure, smelling, I mean, just an intense smell and feeling of heat that, I mean, you just never forget it. Got off the plane. They brought us, there was about 10 of us or so that went over there. Brought us to a barracks that had not even been completed yet. We went to a place called Tien Shan. It was a naval support activity. T-I-E-N, second word, S-H-A. It was a naval support activity, and they were still building the barracks. So 2 o'clock in the morning, I had to string my own rack, canvas, and put the strings in it and do all that. I was still dressed in my whites, and you jump aboard. They wake you up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, because we were in transit, we had no place to go. We went to Chow. They marched us back. Then we, because you have no job, they put you on work parties. And so my very first day in Vietnam, I was waiting around wondering what to do. In one of my letters, which I still have, back to my parents about my first day there, I say in that letter that I was scared and didn't really know what was going to happen, so I went down to the armory and checked out a 45 just to have. Now, looking back on it now, I don't know if that was true or not, but I said that in a letter. Because I don't know if they'd give me, a guy in transit who's an E2, a 45 of my own. There was no reason for me to have one, except I was scared. I remember the barracks, I can visualize this. I remember the barracks were right next to the wire. And I remember looking out to the right and seeing nothing but open plains. And basically, you know, if there was Viet Cong out there, there was. It scared me that we were so exposed, but that's the way it was. But anyway, my very first day in Vietnam, I was 19. And I was put on a work party, and am I talking too much?
No.
I was put on a work party, and the work party was to go to a helipad near the hospital and be a medevac stretcher barrier. And of course, I had no idea what to expect, but and I was a big guy, I was very strong, probably why I was chosen. And I never thought about this until about a year ago. When I was lecturing Tamalpais High School students, one of the questions they presented to me was, what was the most emotional time you had when you were in service? And I never thought about this. And I thought about, God, I never asked that before. And all of a sudden, it hit me, and I actually started crying. What I did for my very first day in Vietnam was take stretchers off helicopters of guys who were messed up. And I bled up to my elbows. And I think two guys that I saw died right there. And my very first day in Vietnam is when I kind of shut down emotionally. Because it was very, very scary. And I realized, holy shit, you know, this is serious stuff. And I think in that CD I gave you, I represent that too. But it was probably a little more shock than I needed or expected or had to have. But it certainly prepared me for the rest of the war.
How are the other people you were working with reacting to it?
I didn't pay attention. You know, we just took each end of the stretcher, just did our job, and we didn't really talk a whole lot. And I remember.
Were some of the people you were taking off the helicopters already dead?
I don't remember that. I don't think so. But I know at least one guy, maybe two, died as I was taking him off to an ambulance. In fact, I remember what the guy looked like. Blonde-haired guy, about my age. I remember he was pockmarked. I think he was hit by a claymore or some type of mine. He was pockmarked from head to toe. You know, his uniform was torn up, and his face was all these pockmarks. You know, basically shrapnel wounds. Mm-hmm. And I was looking right down at him. You know, I still remember what he looked like. But that was that was a huge emotional point of my war experience.
How long did that time last? That shift?
The rest of my life.
No.
The shock of that didn't. I mean, I still think about that, and but the shock of that day didn't last that long. It maybe lasted during that period, because we were there all day long. You know, that whole experience, I can't say really had a... Well, I can't say it didn't have a big effect on me, because I pretty much put walls up, emotional walls. But as far as freaking out, you know, it passed pretty quickly.
Was there any kind of help? Or opportunity to talk to anybody about it?
No. Yeah, you're a man. I knew that. And that's war. That's the way it is. And it was only one day for me, too. And then after that, I flew to Japan. Next day, my ship had detached from the combat operation and was heading home, back to Japan. So almost the very next day, I jumped on a plane on a C-130 and flew from Da Nang to Tachikawa Air Force Base. In Japan, took a bus down to Yokosuka Naval Base, which is about 30 miles south of Tokyo, and I was there for a week, and then my ship came in, and then I went aboard. I boarded aboard April 24th, 1967.
And then that ship returned to Vietnam?
Oh, yeah, that was my home. That was my ship. That was my duty station. I was there for the next 2 years. And that was my place, and we went back to Vietnam all the time.
Did you have conversations with fellow soldiers about the course of the war?
No. We just did our job. When you're in the service, you're really apolitical. At least that's the way we were back then. One of the things I tell kids also, they go, what was the service like? And what boot camp teaches you, first of all, it teaches you to function no matter where you go, no matter where you are. If you're within the Army or within the Navy, they teach you how to function. No matter what ship, no matter what duty station, they teach you the Navy way. They teach you how to follow orders, and they teach you how to work as a team. So when you go on board ship, and to the kids I usually describe it like a soccer game, regardless of what your position is, every single position is vital. Whether you're the one scoring the points or the one defending the goal, if one person in that soccer team doesn't do their job, the whole team is going to fall apart. That's the same way the services are. You know, for every one guy on the front line shooting guns and killing people, there are probably 8 to 10 people behind him supporting him. They may never see combat. But if one of them doesn't do their job, the guy on the front line fails. And that's the way it is in the Navy, too. I had a specific job, and so you kind of erase from your mind the political aspects of it or whatever emotional ramifications you might have. What you're concerned about doing is doing your job, taking care of yourself, and taking care of your buddy. That's all that matters. The guys in Iraq, they don't care, you know, about President Bush or anything like that. They care about doing their job and protecting themselves and protecting their buddies. You know, when you're out in the service, regardless of what your job is, it's not baseball, mom, and apple pie. Not even close. It's taking care of yourself, taking care of your buddies, and doing your job, and not failing your buddies. And that is the bottom line. It's been that way since the Revolutionary War. It was that way in World War II, and I'm sure it still is. Mm-hmm. And it's the way it worked for me.
Do you remember the first time you met any Vietnamese face-to-face, either in combat or not?
Well, I know... well, I mean, I saw a lot. When I was in Da Nang, the first time I was there, we drove through town, and I remember seeing him on the side of the road. When I was, and that was my only time in Vietnam on shore until I came back down there on the ship. Probably my closest experience with I've been to Saigon, although I didn't have any interaction with any Vietnamese people, but I saw them, and they were right next to me and all that. And, of course, when you're in Vietnam, you're always tense. You're always scared to a certain degree. Now, if you're in combat, it's a high degree. When you're just sitting around having lunch, you're scared, you're tense, but it just depends on the degree, you know, how scary it is. In 1968, and I was an old veteran by now, 1968, I've been over there, you know, over a year, and I remember getting up for I was in the Mekong Delta in the Riverine Force, and this is probably an extreme example, but it's an example. I was walking down toward the mess decks, the kitchen, the chow hall, on board ship to get some a sandwich, because before when I watched, we always had something to eat. And then I was going to go up the bridge and stand watch from midnight to 4 o'clock in the morning or something. And I was walking in there, everything, all the lights were out because we were dark on ship. And I remember walking towards some really bright lights, and I didn't know what, it was right near the armory on board ship. And as I got closer, there was a detainee right there. And I realized this, and he had a blindfold on and hand, you know, little handcuffs and all that. And there were army guys with guns on him, and I had to walk right through the middle of that. And that was a little scary, but I just, you know, seeing this kid, you know, he was probably that tall and definitely a VC or whatever. But, you know, I didn't say anything to him. I just said, guys, I need to get by. So they raised their weapons and I walked by, but, that was the only experience I ever had that close as far as really having somebody right next to me. But I never had a reason to talk to any of them, because when I would go to Saigon, I'm jumping around a little bit, I apologize. In 68, I was in the Mekong Delta with the Riverine Force, and we would go through charts. We would tear them up very quickly. The charts were how we plotted our positions. And I would have to go to Saigon every now and then and pick up new charts. And we were in a place called Dong Tam, which was, I don't even know how far away from Saigon it was. But typically I would get on a helicopter, and I would fly to a place called Na Bay, which is a big PBR base there. I could show you these things on a map if I had one. Actually, I do. And then I'd take a 2.5-deuce big truck with some other people. I had to go up there, and I'd take that up to Saigon. And I'd go to the oceanographic office at Tanzanian Air Base, pick up charts, had lunch there, and then we'd go back. And I was usually with an officer. I had a .45, you know, assigned to me, so I was armed also. And I remember one time, first time I was up there, we were assigned this Jeep with an Army driver. And I'd never been to Saigon before, and either had the officer I was with, so he gave us a whole tour of the city. I still have pictures of it. So driving through downtown Saigon in an open Jeep in 1968, That was an interesting experience. I was scared, but I was, you know, I'd been there for a while, so, you know, you're just very, very alert. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting experience driving around. I remember seeing the presidential palace, and I remember in the papers in 62 or 3, I saw where the Buddhist guy burned himself to death. So I said, let's drive by that. And I saw that, took a picture of it. We went through Tanzanute. We drove through the marketplace. So I was around a lot of Vietnamese, but I never really had a chance to interact with any of them.
What was their reaction to you all in the Jeep? Did they pay any attention?
No, they were used to.
Turn away?
No, they were used to. You know, this was 4 years, well, 3 or 4 years in the war. So and Saigon was full of military. So we were just another Jeep, you know, didn't even notice us probably.
What was your main job?
My main job was aboard ship, and I was the person that would get us where we had to go. I was a navigator. So I took the sights of the stars. I was also a master helmsman, and so if there was any going in and out of harbor or where there had to be some real tricky steering or some real dangerous operations, I was on the helm because I was the best helmsman on the ship. But my main job was navigation. I was enlisted navigation. There was always an officer who was the navigator. Mm-hmm. We were kind of his assistants, but we did all the work. We kept the ship's log. We read the lights. We kept the officer of the deck informed about weather. We were kind of oceanographers also. But mainly we made sure that we got where we were supposed to go on the, at the right time and safely.
That's a huge responsibility.
Oh, yeah, I loved it, though. It was great. I look at the guys on the deck force who were chipping paint. I was always clean. I worked with officers, and they weren't always the most fun, but at least there was, we had intelligent conversations, if we had any conversations at all. I was the third person to find out what was going on. When new orders came in, the first people who got it was radioman, because that's how it came in. The second person who got it was the captain. The third person who got it was me, because I had to plot the course. And so I always knew what was going on.
And what was the job, the main job or jobs of the ships themselves?
Well, again, just like every person has a job, every ship has a certain role in the mm-hmm. big picture. And the LST job was to provide transportation, support, resupply, barracks, food, ammunition, whatever it took to support ongoing operations. Mm-hmm. In 1967, most of where we were was between Da Nang and a place called Quaviet, which is about 5 miles south of the DMZ. And we worked with Marines, and so we would have Marines aboard. We would land them. We'd have these, just like you see on in the movies, these big landings. We would frequently go up to Okinawa and pick up jeeps or ammunition or other supplies, bring them back down to the operations. Place called White Beach, Red Beach, Da Nang. You know, we would provide an awful lot of supply, resupply stuff. In the Mekong Delta, we acted as a barrack ship and kind of a home base for the riverine force. We provided barracks. We provided food, we provided ammunition, we provided all this stuff and kind of a home base for them, mm-hmm. plus security too. We provided, in the Delta, you always had to watch out for Viet Cong UDT. In fact, one of the ships, one of my sister ships, who relieved us 2 weeks before, got blown up and 26 guys died in Westchester County, November 1st, 1968. There's a lot of news on that. I could show you articles. But we provided boats to go around the nest, we said. The nest was this. See, here's all big pontoons, mm-hmm. all the riverine boats alongside, and then they would, this was basically where they would land, and they would come up and get a shower, have a fat shower, get resupplied. So this was the nest. We'd have a boat coming around there 24 hours a day, throwing concussion grenades over the side to make sure there's anybody floating in the water. We would kill them. We also had people on board the decks, fore and aft, with 30 caliber machine guns and a 50 caliber machine gun to shoot any sticks we saw in the water or anybody we saw swimming or whatever.
Did you shoot too?
I never pulled a trigger on anything, but I did man a 50 caliber machine gun twice. And thank God I never had to shoot it. It scared the hell out of me. But I was prepared to do that, but I never, but that wasn't my job. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, this is something we try to get across to the kids. We have maybe four people in the classroom, and the kids are saying, what's it like to kill people? What's it like to get shot at? You know, what's it like to, you know, this and that? It's, well, it wasn't my job, you know. Mm-hmm. Was, my job was to drive. My job was to get us there and keep us safe. You know, just like in the Army. If you get through boot camp and you become 11 Bravo, everybody has a code. Mm-hmm. 11 Bravo is an infantryman. And the majority of the guys who go in the Army become infantrymen because that's where you need them. But you might otherwise become a radioman or a postal clerk or a cook or a corpsman or whatever. Everybody has a job. You know, there's certain people who shoot and other people who do something else. And my job wasn't to shoot. If it got that bad, I all of a sudden became a rifleman. That's the way everybody is. On the small boats, my job on the small boats might have been navigation and signaling and communication. But if the shit hit the fan, I better grab myself a gun and shoot back. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't my primary job.
Did you ever want to be an infantryman?
No. No, too scary. Yeah. You always anticipate having to do that. And when we were in the Mekong Delta, we were very exposed. I don't know if you ever saw Apocalypse, the movie, but going up the river with no, that's the way it was, no protection whatsoever. So it was very scary going up and down the river. But no, I never hoped that I would have to fire a gun. I never had to.
Is it a comfort to you now knowing that that you didn't personally shoot anybody?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, there are two things that veterans come home with after going to war, generally speaking. One thing is survival guilt. When you go to war, and if you don't get hurt like your buddy did, or you don't get killed, a lot of guys have a tendency to be terribly guilty that, why wasn't it me? And that goes along with the fact, thank God it wasn't. But survivor guilt is rampant in the service. Because again, you're a team. Those are your brothers. If somebody gets killed, you didn't do your job. You know, it's all over the place. Survivor guilt's a big thing. And survivor guilt is a big reason why people commit suicide. You know, because they just can't deal with that kind of pressure. And I've known at least 6 people here in Marin County who have committed suicide in the last 20 years. Wow. I knew personally.
Who had been in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. They don't get put in the paper, though.
You didn't... Were you ever in a situation where someone was killed right next to you?
Yes.
On the boat?
Yeah, it was down the Delta. But, you know, I know it wasn't my fault, but it was... In fact, it was a friend of mine, a guy named Bob Andrews, who was from Reno. But anyway, the other thing that's rampant in the service is feeling like you didn't do enough. You know, you see these guys who have all the ribbons and all this and that, and they were here and they were there and all that, and then you might... When I first got involved with Vietnam Vets of America, which was 1991, I was in very, very bad shape, because when Desert Storm happened, or whatever that was, the Gulf War, when they declared that, I went off the edge. I hadn't realized how bad I had post-stress and how messed up I was because of the war, because we kept it in all the time. And that's a whole other story, but I'll hear that. But when I first started going to Vietnam Vets, and it's a group of about 35 guys at that time, who, you know, it's Vietnam Vets is supposed to provide a safe environment for veterans to heal or have brotherhood or whatever. And I would blurt out these stories, these experiences of mine, like when I was carrying the stretchers or saw this guy die or being really scared about some situation. And then I go, but I was only in the Navy. You know, I didn't measure up to being a real veteran. And that affects a lot of guys, too. They don't feel like they measure up. My stories aren't as good as yours, so obviously I didn't do anything. You know, I can't compare anything. And a lot of guys, even guys who are heavy, heavy-duty combat, you know, have a lot of that stuff, too.
Did you first recognize it then?
Or
did
no.
they help you recognize
they,
it?
They helped me. They helped me get through it. I had incredible anger for probably 30 years. And the only time I showed it was in private, and usually it was during the political times, when all these people were lying through their teeth.
You mean politicians or friends?
Politicians, yeah. You know, when I was 17, 18 years old, I was the all-American kid. And I mean, I was patriotic, and I still am, but, you know, I believed going that we were moral, and we were right, and we were this, and we were that. And I went in the service, and I was proud of my service, and I still am. And even today, if there was a reason for me to go back in, I would. I think that's kind of weird, but no, I enjoyed being in the service. The brotherhood was incredible. One thing I would have never forgiven myself for is to not be able to experience the camaraderie in the service. It's incredible. But no, Vietnam never messed me up. Going over there and doing my job, I never felt like I had to feel guilty about anything. I didn't necessarily agree with the war after I'd seen the people and been over there and all that. But I could defend it. Even today, I could defend domino theory. And I could also defend never going there in the first place. I can take either side. I think both of them have legitimacy. But Vietnam never messed me up. What messed me up was coming home. And I think a lot of veterans will never admit that, but that's true for them too, is that they did their job. They saved their buddies. They saved themselves. They feel very good about their service and their experience, and they come home. And I remember the first time I came home after 2 years being overseas was in 1969. And I was walking down the street. This was in July, 69. And I was to go back over again. But, you know, I was a nice kid, and I was happy-go-lucky Ernie, and, you know. And I was walking down Broadway Street in San Diego, around 3rd or 4th Street in my uniform. A guy came up and spit on me and called me a baby killer. And I was just totally shocked. He spit right on my ribbons. And so I got a paper and I wiped my uniform off a little bit. It totally blew me away. And I heard about this happens, you know. Anyway, that was my first incident. I still remember what the guy looked like. Tall, skinny, dark hair. Probably in his early 30s, but anyway. Then I went back overseas. I went for my second tour, which was a year, 8 months. I'd already been there 2 months, or 2 years. I'd go over one more time. Then I got back, and I got out of my service, and I was going to go to college in Marin, and I had already learned to not talk about it. But being a 22-year-old freshman in college, at college Marin, you kind of stick out, as all the veterans did. So people kind of knew who we were, because we were older than everybody else, 1970. And twice at the Marin College of Marin Student Center, I got hot coffee thrown at me and got called a baby killer by girls. I remember specifically, I was so angry. I jumped up, and she got really scared, and she ran away from me. You know, but I remember having hot coffee thrown at me twice, and that just pissed me off. So, like, you learn to kind of hide. And then the thing that probably got me the worst was when I was a junior in high school, I don't know if your parent were familiar with this, but they have a thing called Boy State through the American Legion. And Boy State still exists, a citizenship program. And every school gets to pick one guy and one girl, depending on how many chapters are there, to represent the entire high school at the citizenship program. And they take you for a week to Sacramento, and you learn how elections work and democracy and blah, 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 blah. And I was chosen for Tam High School. Like, I still have pictures of that, too. And I was so proud. And I was so full of patriotism of America and so proud that I was even qualified, because don't forget, I never was going to amount to anything. And I remember being in a room full of 500 guys from all over the United States. And I could not figure out why I was there, but I was part of these guys. And we sang the national anthem and all this, just brought me to tears. And so I could not wait to be one of the boys. I couldn't wait to get the American Legion. But, of course, I had to be a veteran. So I went in the service and 4 years there and blah, 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 and get back. And the first thing I did when I got back is I joined the American Legion, gave them my 10 bucks or whatever it was, and signed up. But I was, because of everything that was going on, I was just terrified to go to a meeting. You know, even in college, you know, there was a problem with being a veteran. But I was terrified. So I waited 5 years before I even went to a meeting. In 1975, I finally went to a meeting. And I walked in, and some guy meets me at the door and says, "What can I help you?" And I go, "Yeah, you know, I've been a member for 5 years. This is my first meeting." And he goes, "Oh, where'd you serve?" And I said, "Well, I served in Vietnam." He says, "Oh, well, wait right here." And so I wait for about a minute or so. Another guy comes out, big guy, says, "We're really sorry, but we don't want you here. You know, we don't like you guys. We don't think you're veterans. Don't ever come back." And I just, my world just crumbled. And I still have problems with that. But I mean, that was the big blow.
Where was this?
San Rafael. I just got there on the wrong night. Luck and timing. It's the way life is. But I was devastated.
And these were full of themselves World War II vets or something?
Yeah. And that went on for a long time. I mean, I was the only person that happened to. But I mean, the World War II guys, you know, never gave us any credit for anything for a long time. They still don't, some of them don't, but that's beside the point. from that point on, I never, ever talked about being a veteran, ever. Probably another 15, 20 years. And I had so much anger. I would sit here, wherever I was, and see what was going on through the government and see the lies they would, and all the politicians and all the bullshit that would go down. And I would literally get up and yell at the TV and yell at me, say, "Why are you doing this?" You know, and just, I was just crushed. But, you know, when Desert Storm happened, and I'd, you know, gone through life, and I'd very successful in business, and had a lot of friends, but I always had this underlying thing. You know, some of my friends that were not vets never understood that. And so I just didn't talk about it around them either. Maybe one guy I would talk to, but they never understood my anger. And I would sometimes tell some of my friends, "Well, you know, this just really makes me angry. You don't have any reason to be angry. You didn't get shot at. You know, you didn't do this." I never really talked about my experiences. They thought, you know, I was just in the Navy. You know, I just went over there and got back. And then in 1991, we invaded Iraq. I still hate that day. And that week, I just happened to have a cold, a really bad cold. So I took the week off. I never take any time off, ever. And it just so happened that was the week the war started. And so I became obsessed with CNN. And I cried, and I couldn't sleep, and I was yelling at the TV again. 10,000, you know, acceptable. What are you guys talking about? 10,000 acceptable, you know. When Schwarzenegger would say, we're expecting 10,000. Yeah, give me up. You know, I just drove me nuts. So luckily, a really good friend of mine, who you should also interview, Corky Corcoran, who grew up in Marina Mill Valley, 173rd Airborne, great guy. He came by and saw me one time, and he saw what kind of shape I was in. And he dragged me down to this meeting. And of course, my first meeting there, I was so nervous because I just was in the Navy.
Now, this is a meeting of Viet Vets?
Yeah, Vietnam Vets. First one I ever went to in February, March of 91. And we go around and introduce ourselves and talk about what was... Everybody had a chance to kind of vent. And I don't remember what I said at that meeting, but I said something like, my name's Ernie Bergman, and I was just in the Navy, and, you know. And then somebody else would talk, and they would say something that would remind me, and I would blurt out these stories. You know, things that really just had been with me for too many years. And most of the guys didn't like me that first couple weeks, first couple months, because I was so rude, because I was like, you know, interrupting and saying, yeah, I know that. I know what that's like. They eventually got to know me, but. Anyway, for the next 4 years, and of course, the woman I was with at the time supported me, sort of, but she really wasn't sympathetic because, you know, I was just in the Navy, but she put up with me going to these meetings all the time. For the next 4 years, I went through Monday night, every night group counseling, Monday night, once a week for 4 years, trying to resolve all this stuff. And it didn't resolve my, it helped me resolve my anger. Let me learn how to control it, because I don't, you know, I get emotional sometimes when I talk about something. Sometimes when I'm talking to the kids in the high schools, and I'll bring up this or that, something I never cried about before, I'll just break down right there. I never know what's going to happen. Something I was able to walk through and talk about and this and that last time, I can't get through it this time. It varies.
Did you ever either go back to or send a friend back to the American Legion place in San Rafael?
No. I never went back, ever. Was afraid to, but also never went back. Never even talked about that until probably 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, of course, any American Legion guy didn't believe it anyway, but that's what it was. But when people would ask me about where I stood with Vietnam, or post-stress, or, you know, all these afflictions that they kind of stereotype with the Vietnam vet, I says, hey, Vietnam didn't mess me up. America messed me up. I hate my country. Or I don't hate my country, I hate my government. My government's what messed me up. You know, the American people. No, seriously, I hated the American people. Not America, but the people. And I still have some of that in me.
Mm-hmm. Well, these were all essentially civilians who were so...
Oh, I know. I know. But, you know, it was so bad that, and I was so angry, and still am to a certain extent, although I'm much more controlled now. Part of the Vietnam vet goal was to get us, we call it in the bunker, get us out of the bunker. You know, when you go back to the bunker, you're hiding, and you're hiding your emotions. I fall back into it already. I had a meeting last night with some guys, but part of it is to get us out of the bunker. So, of course, because, I mean, the Vietnam Vets of America didn't really build until the Desert Storm War. All across the United States, that's when all of a sudden, because Vietnam was coming out of the bush, coming out of the bunker saying, I need some help. There was no place to go before. And so, you know, when I went to my first VBA meeting, it was like 35 guys there, all really messed up from all different parts of the service.
Where was it?
We first met at the Salvation Army in San Rafael, and then we went to Whistle Stop Wheels, and now we meet in Larkspur. I've been president about four times, you know, but that's beside the point. What we would do is we would March in Memorial Day parades. We decided this was a good idea. This is going to help us get out of the bunker. And I remember the very first parade that I marched in was Mill Valley, Memorial Day Mill Valley. And there were about 20 of us, you know, that were, as we had a lot of activity, and we were all kind of into it. We were all supporting each other. The last parade I'd ever marched in was when I was in Little League, from Old Mill School to Ball Park. And the next parade I marched in was this one in 1991 or two, as a Vietnam veteran. And part of me was very excited about it. A lot of me was with my brothers, and that's as far as it went. It's like in the service. You're a team, you're a unit, you're with your brothers. There's nothing outside of that. And part of me was very, very angry because I knew all my experiences and all the bullshit that went down to vets. And now I remember walking, specifically, I remember walking down Throckmorton. And we're going right by the intersection there where Miller Avenue comes in. And people were applauding and cheering, all right, Vietnam vets. And I got very angry. I got pissed. And I thought, it's too late. I cannot accept this. It's too late. And I got really angry. And I looked at the people, and I couldn't look at them. Because it brought all my anger back. And from this day, I still can't walk in a parade. I wish I could let that go. But I cannot, when it comes to people all of a sudden coming back and saying, I had some other things happen to me, too, that I forgot to bring up. I had a girlfriend who I just really, really enjoyed. And the first time I came back, I wanted to go by and show her all my pictures, you know, and I was good old Ernie, and look what I experienced. And she threw me out of the house. She wouldn't see me. That also, but that's beside the point. But I wish that I could accept. I wish I knew how to forgive. I can't do that yet. I can live my life now. I can be friends with people. But I can't forgive yet.
And so the people now saying, cheering Viet vets going by on Throckmorton are maybe just the same grown-up people who threw coffee.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I, intellectually, I understand. Well, maybe they, obviously things have changed and they learned lessons from Vietnam, but I can't forgive them yet. And I get angry when there are, now I am very against the Iraqi war. I understand the troops there. You know, they're doing their job. They're, you know, I know exactly how they feel. I think Bush is, I hate Bush. I hate Craig Cheney. I hate all that. I hate the whole war. But I get angry when they have war protests and marches and all that. Especially when they have a lot of people saying, to hell with the war, but before the troops, because to me that's very confusing. Because I know when I was overseas, and when I was in Vietnam and I heard about a war protest or a demonstration, I took it very personally. And I felt like I was being protested against myself personally. And I knew that wasn't true. But that's how I took it. And so I look at the people out there saying, to hell with Iraq war, but we love the troops. I find that very hypocritical. And I know that may not be true, but in English I know that's not necessarily maybe true. But I still have a hard time with that.
So would you...
We're getting awfully deep, you know,
no,
in this.
That's fine. Would you oppose people protesting the war as other than privately, as you do? I mean, you're against the war privately.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you where a lot of my anger is right now. I am all for a draft. I am so pro-draft, I can't stand it. But not a military draft, a service draft. I would have everybody 18 to 24, whatever, male, female, black, white, smart, stupid, poor, everybody has to go, 18 months, 2 years, whatever. And you have three choices. You either choose to go and do civilian service, domestic, foreign service, or military. And it's first come, first service, first come, first serve. So if you want to get over with, you get go in there and get your choice. If you wait till the very end, it's military, but you have a choice. But everybody has to serve. And I also feel very strongly that if all the senators and all the presidents and all the decision makers had one of their kids or relatives on the front line, they would make decisions a lot different. And I also say that if you want this war to end, don't go out and demonstrate. Get a draft in there and have everybody have something at risk. You're gonna stop that war. That's the way it's going to stop it. If idiot Bush or Cheney or whoever else has their kids at risk, that's when you're going to stop that war. Government doesn't pay attention to a bunch of demonstrations. They may feel good, but it's not going to do anything. Did I answer your question? I don't know. because of my, I guess my, kind of protection that I build up around me about all this stuff, I don't know if I have an opinion about people demonstrating. All I know is that it makes me angry. Mm-hmm. When they bring up support the troops, and although I thoroughly agree with that, and I certainly do myself, I have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I have a problem forgiving because of what happened to us. And maybe I take it too seriously. Maybe I shouldn't take it that seriously, but I just... And I was only in the Navy. And I don't really measure up to a real veteran, although, I mean, I'm being facetious, but, mm-hmm. you know, why should I be so sensitive about that? But no, I was, and I almost feel embarrassed saying this, I was hurt too deeply when I first got back to even let it go now. And hell, I'll be 60 next week. And I just, I feel very strong. It doesn't affect my life on a day-to-day basis. Still, a lot of people I know don't even know I was a veteran, but deep down inside, I have very strong feelings about that.
What led to your going to Tam High to talk to the students there?
Part of it was therapy. A lot of it, I like to talk. I'm a big, obviously, you can tell I talk to anybody, but I like teaching. I enjoy being in front of an audience and trying to give them something they can bite into. A lot of it was, we have some guys in our chapter that are really messed up. We have some guys in our chapter that hate the Army, hate everything. Nothing about that war, nothing about the service, nothing about anything was any good. We have other guys in the thing that loved it. A guy named Frank Archibald, who was a Marine, sniper scout. Boy, he just goes in there and he laughs. Oh, we shot this and we did this and it was just great. And one of the reasons why I think it's necessary for me to be there is I provide balance. Because I can go in there and say, you know, one thing I will not accept is that the military is bad. I hate those people in Berkeley saying, get the Marines out of here. Because the military, for me, was very good. And for some kids, the military is just like my pro-draft. There are so many kids today who feel entitled where they shouldn't. There's so many kids these days, young people, whatever, who have no respect for anybody. There's so many kids these days that don't know how to compromise, don't know how to play as a team, don't know how to interact with other people. And that's partly what the service does. You have to learn how to get along. You have to learn how to play as a team. You have to learn how to focus on a certain thing and not just yourself. And, when I say I joined the service to see the world, which is one of my cliches, I saw the world. Let me tell you, it did exactly what I wanted the service to do for me. It grew me up. It gave me confidence. I saw the world. I met some great people. And I walked out of there a man. Where I went in as just a kid. And so it gets me angry when certain veterans go in there and says, the Army sucks. And no, don't ever do that. Deal with this. That puts a, you know, rise to the back of my neck just as much as anything else. Because I don't think that's fair.
But back to Tam High, was it your idea?
No, they were already... We have a thing called an educational committee.
It was Viet Vets.
From Viet Vets. Mm-hmm. And it was part of what they were doing. At, you know, community service. And also some of the high school... In 1991, the war was only about 15 or 20 years old, so kids still could relate to it, you know, through an uncle or a dad or something like that. And because the Gulf War was so confusing, and these kids were 17, 18 years old... A lot of the history teachers around the county requested that we come in and talk about it. You know, and when the history books get around to Vietnam around April or May, toward the end of the year, that's when we go in there. Because all of a sudden they're reading about this thing, and they bring us in just to give them a frame of reference.
Have you found that they're well-informed or not well-informed?
Very. Some teachers require their kids to do a lot of research. We walked into other classes and gave them kind of our opening little spiel and said, okay, to quit. And kids don't say a thing. They just, you know, they're just, yeah, help me with this. Kids don't even have a clue what we said.
Oh, really?
And that makes me mad, but...
You mean they thought you fought the Nazis?
They don't even know what that is. You know, I mean, that history, you know, and I love history. It's one of my passions. When I watched Jay, you watch Leno?
A little.
You ever seen the Jay walking when he asks questions on the people on the street?
No. embarrassing.
Oh, it makes me so angry. Yeah. People have no sense of history. Some of the kids don't have a clue. We had one kid one time a couple of years ago say, well, I have no I can't relate to Vietnam. I have no idea what you guys are talking about, and I don't care. That's fine. But some class, and it's really the teacher's fault. But, you know, a lot of the teachers who pay attention and make the kids work a little bit, they have good questions. And we've been in there when some kid wanted to join the service, and he'd salute me. I go, don't salute me. I'm not an officer. But, you know, it varies. It's all over the street. For the most part, we've had good experiences, but some of them have been bad. We get the same questions. What's it like to kill people? What's it like to be shot at? What do you think of Iraq? What do you think of Bush? And one of the things, and this is on that other thing too, probably the first thing that I try to get down to people is don't stereotype a veteran. You know, for every single guy who comes out of a Vietnam movie, oh, they asked me what movie was the most accurate. They asked me that too. For every one veteran who comes out of a movie and says, God, that's exactly the way it was. 10,000 other guys are going, it wasn't my war. You know, although veterans may have similar jobs, maybe been at similar places, we all have different, and obviously a lot of guys can be the same, but in the big picture, you can't stereotype a veteran. We all had our own wars. And one thing that I have learned since I've been in DVA is I also don't stereotype myself either, which a lot of guys, like, oh, I didn't do enough. You have to realize that what this other guy's talking about wasn't your war. You have to appreciate your own war and your own experience, and you have to understand that that was as legitimate as anybody else's. But don't like these kids come in and go, well, how many of you guys kill? Because their impression of the military guy is all we do is shoot people. And that's not the point. So that's a big point I try to make is, wait a minute, you know, you're a soccer team. You don't all kill, and you know all this, and you all got to work together. And some guy was in the Central Highlands of Vietnam has no clue what my war was all about because I was in a Mekong Delta. And some guy was on an aircraft carrier 50 miles. He might have been at risk. He might have had a lot of stress. But he had a certain job to play, and I don't have a clue what his job was. And some guy who, another thing he asked us too. Did you do a lot of drugs? And what's the other thing? Oh, race riots. How many race riots were you in? Did you do a lot of drugs? And I tell him this. I said, drugs thing, the first time I ever saw dope on grass was in Bangkok on R&R. First time I ever smoked grass was in R&R in 1968. When you're on the front lines, drugs are not on the front lines. If you can't depend on your buddy, you're going to throw them off. You're going to get them out of there. Race riots, same thing. If you're in combat, not acceptable. Everybody's the same color on the front lines. And it depends on when you were there. If you were there in 65, 66, 67, 68, that was when society was still pretty clean. But we went through a tremendous change back in America. So if you were there in 67, 65, 66, whatever, the likelihood of you seeing drugs or having any real racial problems were not nil, but certainly didn't show up. But if you were there in 19, and also depending on where you were stationed. If you were where I was, where you are captured, you are in a small environment, you don't leave it. Or if you were on the front lines, you will not see drugs. But if you're stationed in Saigon, you got a lot of time on your hands, you got a lot of people around, and you were there in 1970, guaranteed you're going to have fights, you're going to have drugs. So it depends on your MOS, military occupational specialty. Mm-hmm. Depends on where you're stationed and what you were there, as to the frequency or even the occurrence of that kind of stuff.
And you were there well before fragging.
Oh, yeah. Well, fragging happened, but fragging got a lot more later. Mm-hmm. You know, this may be too strong, but when I look at society and the disciplines of society really broke down in America, they broke down in the war too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Like one mirrored the other.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll give you an example. This is a poor example, but this is one that I remember. I went over in 1967 when black people were called colored. Now, most people in the Army went over for 12 months and they came home. Marines were 13 months and went home. I was there for 2 years. So I kind of bounded over a couple different generations of society behavior. When I got back, the blacks were called black. You know, and I remember standing in a line in a hamburger joint in Yokosuka, Japan, late 68, and there was a white guy and a black guy, and somehow the word colored came up, and the black guy said, well, no, I'm not colored, I'm black. And I'm going, wow, you know, things are changing. I mean, that's a stupid example, but an example about how, depending on when you were there, how you have a whole different frame of reference of things.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any contact with Desert Storm or Current Iraq veterans?
No, not personally, but I know that even last night, we have a lot of money in the bank right now, and so we want to directly contribute to help Desert Storm, so we're contributing money to these care package programs. Care package is a little, it's all Navy slang, where you send cookies and candy and all that stuff overseas. And we're contributing probably $1,000 to that. And we try to contribute to the family support programs for the injured vets and all that. But otherwise, you know, when the wars first started a couple of years ago, Vietnam vets actually took a vote at their national convention. Do we open up our doors to Iraqi vets? And we decided no, because we're Vietnam vets, but we also want to make sure we have an outreach. Well, in the meantime, Iraqi vets have created their own organization, which they need just as much as we did, because they get more support. But I feel sorry for those guys. All the injuries and all the PTSD, and most of those guys are National Guard. The worst thing they expect to do is go down and help put sandbags up for a flood. And now they're over there with this stupid thing going on and getting blown away. I really feel sorry for those guys. And they have a reason to bitch. When they went over there with not even enough armor for their body to spare themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't believe it.
Yeah.
So I support them totally. But I don't see any solution. Even if Obama gets in, I don't know if he's going to be able to stop that war.
Hmm.
Is this going the way you want it to go?
Yes.
No, let's not start yet. I'm going to show you something. I'm not.
No, this is fine. I was curious anyway, but
I got back. I mentioned that I may have mentioned on tape that when I first went in the service, I had no desire to go to college at all.
Mm-hmm.
30 minutes into boot camp, I wanted to go to college so bad, but obviously I waited 4 years. I actually got a 3-month school cut when I had enlisted for 4 years, but I actually was only in for 3 years and 9 months. Because not only was Nixon cutting back on the troops anyway, but I also applied for a 3-month school cut, and they approved it because we were cutting down on forces anyway. So instead of being relieved of duty September 1, I got out June 1, 1970.
Uh-huh.
I was 22. And, you know, a much different person can have it going in, but still happy-go-lucky and full of fun and vinegar and all that. I was out of the service for 1 month. I know I had to find a job, so I was actually doing maintenance work with a buddy of mine. On apartments, laying skin, doing maintenance work and all that. And he wanted to buy a shirt one day. And so we drove down to Corbin Air Center. I had no clue this place even existed. Walked to an immense clothing store called Louis George. And while I was in there, I thought, hey, I had dirty jeans on. I was hot, sweaty. I was tired. I thought, this looks like a nice job to have during college. So I went up to the owner and says, you hiring anybody for the summer? And he was so amazed that I was just able to walk up to him and say that. He hired me. And I stayed there for 5 years. Best thing ever happened to me. Paid the bills. That plus GI Bill is what paid for college. My parents, I paid for the whole college myself through GI Bill. And then working at this clothing store. Kept me in good clothes, kept me clean, kept me dry, kept me warm. And the two owners there were pseudo-fathers for me. And they're still good friends.
Oh.
In 1974, I became a business major because I had no one else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I became an accounting major because, like I said, debit, credit.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense to me. I got straight A's in accounting.
Mm-hmm.
Never read a book, ever. Just did the work, took the test, debit, credit. Sounded good to me. About my junior year, I switched back to marketing because I realized that accounting got real boring and marketing was really where I should be.
Mm-hmm.
Graduated college in 1974, and I've always loved the law. I thought, I think I want to go to law school. I took my LSATs, did pretty well on them. Then I realized, again, going back to my mother saying I would never amount to anything, I had no confidence. And also didn't know if I had the money, so I didn't go to law school. Although now I wish I had. I looked for work. I tried to get out. I wanted a real job because I was dying. I felt like I was 4 years behind everybody else because everybody else had their careers going, and I was at 27. I just got out of college.
Mm-hmm.
1974 was not a good time to look for a job. And being a veteran, it was even worse. I mean, we couldn't get hired if we were veterans. They just wouldn't touch us.
Did they say why?
Yeah. They just said no. A lot of times it was pretty obvious, though. So. You know, everything's going really well, and then you have to mention that you were in a war, and all of a sudden the interview stops. So you put up with that, too. Anyway, so I figured, God, I've got to do something. So I applied for grad school and got into grad school, took my DGSB.
Where?
State, San Francisco State. Not really enthused about going to grad school, but I figured I'd get an MBA anyway. I learned one lesson there. Don't do your MBA the same place you did your undergrad. Because I found all I was doing was sending the same teachers with different course titles. And if I ever did it over again, I would say, go to some different school. Do whatever you want. Get any degree you want at some school that's fun. And then get serious about your master's. Go to some different school. But anyway, so about halfway through grad school, and I didn't try that hard. I got good grades, but I didn't try that hard. Mm-hmm. I got a call from a headhunter. And the headhunter says, hey, you want to be a stockbroker? And I go, what's that? I says, well, their investments. And I was a little, again, insecure about my mathematic ability and all that. But I said, sure. It was a job. They were offering it. So I went on an interview and I got hired. So I quit grad school. I quit Lewis George. I went to work for Dean Witter. And I was there for 10 years. Went through training. I was, again, with, just like at Boise State, I was with guys who were so smart. I thought, what the hell am I doing here? You know, again, my lack of confidence. But I passed all the tests and did really well. One of my best friends there was a West Point graduate. Of course, I always loved the military schools, so he and I became friends. There was guys through there who were just brilliant. I still couldn't figure out why I was there, but I was one of the boys. I started being a stockbroker over here in San Rafael at the corner of 3rd and C. Or, no, 4th and C. I did that for 2 years, and, you know, I was doing okay. And then in September 25th of 1977, and I was always a big jock. I was playing tennis. I was playing adult softball, which I loved. You know, I was riding by. I was doing all this stuff. It kept me in shape because I've always been a big guy. I had a softball game on a Sunday, and Monday morning I woke up with an incredible pain in my back, and I had no idea what the hell it was. I mean, I probably just twisted a muscle or something. So I let it go for a couple of days, and I finally went to a doctor, and I said, what is this? This is really, really bothering me. And he says, oh, you probably just have some type of nerve infection, epididymitis, or whatever the hell it is. Here's some antibiotic, and take aspirin for the pain, and you'll be fine. So to make a long story short, over the next 2 months, I was up to maybe 20 aspirin a day, and couldn't sleep and all that. And I went through about 4 or 5 doctors. Nobody knew what the hell it was. I finally got through a urologist, and I finally went in for a CT scan. And when they got me out of the CT scan, they'd taken me in, and they'd removed my right testicle, and they said that was cancerous. But nobody, and then they gave me a big CT scan, and nobody would tell me. So December 14th, I checked it on the 10th. I had the operation on the 4th, on the 11th. I have very good memory for days. Mm-hmm. And then Wednesday night in 1977, I finally demanded to see my doctor because nobody would tell me anything. And so I got, Herbert Lee was his name, and he came in the patient consultation room, where the hell it is. And this was about 6 o'clock in the evening on a Wednesday at Marine General Hospital. I go, well, doc, how's it look? And he said, well, you have cancer. I said, well, I don't really know what question to ask. I never had this before. I said, well, I don't know what to tell you. And I said, well, how long do I have to live? And he said, well, probably 6 weeks. And he walked out the door. I've never seen him since. That's bedside manner.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm going, geez. Oh, so I go back to my room, and actually my roommate knew that I was a dead man. He knew, or the whole floor knew it. The nurses didn't know that. And some of them came in and they cried. And I, you know, hell, I'm half full all the time. And I had a lot of visitors. I mean, I was part of the ski club, the single ski club here, and I was part of American Legion. I was part of Junior, whatever that, Chamber, JCs. I was part of that. I had streams of people in my room, and we had booze in the room, and everybody coming in partying and all that. Somebody brought me a bottle of cognac. It was about 8 o'clock at night on Wednesday. I looked at my roommate, Dick Ewald, and I says, fuck it, Dick, let's get drunk. And so we opened up that bottle of cognac. This is right after I found I was going to die. The nurse kept on coming in and said, Mr. Bergman, can I get you something for the pain? I said, yeah, bring me some more ice. So we'd drink that whole damn bottle that night. And it was weird because I was planning on taking a trip to Europe, but then I was told I was going to die, so I had to cancel. My sister was in Berlin, living in Berlin at the time, 1970, or she was visiting there. And so my cousin happened to be in the area with me, and she was there when I was told I was going to die. She called my sister up in Berlin and said, Julia, get home, your brother's dying of cancer. Well, And my sister and I never really had that good a relationship. Well, my sister was there by Thursday night, back from Berlin. And my sister and I, then we started looking for someone to work on me. And three doctors, at least, two doctors. Dahl and Eisen, somebody here in the county. Look at my x-rays, says, sorry, we can't help you. You know, you're going to die. And then we were referred to UC Med Center in San Francisco to a guy named Sam Newcomb, 34-year-old oncologist. And we get an appointment with him, and he looks at my x-rays and he goes, you're going to die. I said, well, what can I do? It just so happened they were running clinical trials with 50 men across the United States on these brand new types of chemotherapy. And he says, you know, they've never worked before. Everybody's died. They're like less than a 5% chance. And at your stage four, forget about it. However, because we need guinea pigs, I'll try to get special permission to get you in the program. And he was able to do that. So I checked in the UC Med Center on December 21st, 1977, and got my first IV. And I spent the next 6 months in the UC Med Center. They let me in and out because I had to rebuild my strength and rebuild my white counts and all that. But when they found out what my cancer was, they found out that I had cancer all through my back, all through my abdomen, all the way up my spine. I had 12 tumors in my lungs and my entire lymph node system. And I was basically a dead man in late stage four. So I figured, well, okay. And I was smoking still. I smoked 2.5 packs a day.
Oh, jeez.
Smoked in the hospital. They had me fill out sterility forms, malpractice forms, permissions, because it was all experimental. HEW was paying for a lot of this stuff. And I had to get through my insurance. Anyway, okay, let's go. Let's see what, you know, because I was mentally and physically very strong. And that's probably what saved me, physically especially. But okay, let's go for it. To make a long story short, over the next 6 months, I went through throwing up days on every 15, 20 minutes. I went through losing the use of my legs. I had deep inflammatitis in my left leg, which I still have trouble with. I went totally blind for about a week. I was in so much pain that I was addicted to painkillers. Except I had every side effect you can imagine. I was on three separate types of chemotherapy. I was on cisplatinum, which is still very toxic, bleomycin and Valban. And I was on those for 6 months. And they told me if I lived, I'd never walk again. I was in a wheelchair also, and I was so weak, and so I lost my 80 pounds. Best diet I've ever been on. I was so weak I couldn't even hold my body up. I was like, so I had pictures of myself when I was sick, if you want to see them. They're really skinny. They don't look like I'm dying, but I was. Anyway, we went through all the chemotherapy we possibly could, and they couldn't give me any more because it was giving damage to my good organs. I went through a couple more CT scans. Twice I gave up. Twice. The pain was so bad and I was so frustrated that I decided that death was a very attractive alternative. And even today when people come up, you know, like Krikorian and all those guys and talk about death, I understand. The people that say, no, you got to keep them alive, that's bullshit. You know, I totally understand how death can be a very attractive alternative when you're faced with that kind of, because I've been there. But anyway, they decided to operate on me to clear whatever cancer was left over, and they opened me up 10 hours, and they took 117 lymph nodes out, which is why I still have a lot of circulation problems. And that was April 2nd of 78. And I spent 2 weeks in recovery. And interesting, after 1 week of recovery, and I had like 7 tubes in me, IV, collect, you know, nose, you know, breathing thing and all that. And every day they'd maybe take 2 of those out, and when they took the very last tube out, that's when I broke down emotionally. After being so tough for 6 months, I just started crying like a baby, because I finally was able to let go. And I knew then it didn't matter what I did, I either died or I lived, and so I just let it go. Unfortunately, because I'm a guy, I only allowed myself to do that about 10 seconds. I wish I hadn't stopped myself, but it felt good. Anyway, they checked all my pathology stuff, and they realized that I was 100% in remission. First person to go in.
Wow.
Then they said, you know, you're the first one, and we don't want to lose you, so we're putting you on 2 years maintenance chemotherapy. So I was on chemo for a total of 2.5 years. And so after my 6 months of being in the hospital, and I eventually went back to work, I couldn't go to work. I couldn't go work as a stockbroker anymore because I could not take the chance of not being able to go to work because I still was very, very weak. I mean, I was tremendously weak. And I was still on chemo. So I called up the office of Dean Witter in the city and says, hey, Ernie, and everybody knew me. Hey, this is Ernie Bergman. How are you feeling? Well, I'm feeling good. I'd like to find a job. You guys got anything over there for me? So I was hired to be the senior instructor at the National Training Center at Dean Witter. So I taught all the brand new stockbrokers, hires, how to be a stockbroker. I taught them math, heaven forbid. I taught them margins. I taught them securities. I taught them how to, all that stuff. And every single month for the next 2 years, I'd have 4 weeks per month. And I'd have one really, really bad because I got my chemotherapy shot. And I just felt like hell. One time I fainted at the podium when I was teaching. And then I'd have a week when I felt like I had the flu or something. Then I had a week where I felt kind of normal, and then I had a week when I really felt good, and then I get another shot. I went up for 2 years. But, you know, it cured me. And so that was another, and I call this my character-building experiences. The war certainly was, and my cancer certainly was, too. I'm getting so damaged character, I can't stand it. I know what I'm being prepared for. But I worked there, and I got through my chemo, and I was finally went off that, and I've been clear ever since. And when and this is a little bit off the subject, for probably 10 years after that, people knew me. I mean, and knew that I was a cancer survivor. And so if they'd have, like, forums or something with nurses or Army, if they had, especially if people had friends who had cancer, they'd call me up. Already, call this person, they have cancer. I said, no, I'm not going to intrude. When they want to talk to me, here's my number. And that, because I knew that me just going in there was not the right thing to do. Also, they'd say, well, what do you think about my friend who has cancer? And the first thing I would ask is, how physically strong are they? Because I know that you have to be physically strong in order to get through the cure. Chemotherapy probably kills more people than the cancer does. Because it just beats you up so bad. I was lucky because I was 225 pounds and a jock. And very strapping. And so I went in there extremely physically strong. And even though I lost all that weight, I got down there where I was gaunt. I was skeletal. I was able to tolerate all that, where people go in pretty frail. You know, I don't know what that, I had my old boss from Louis George died of cancer, and he just starved to death because he couldn't keep anything down. But anyway, I taught for about a year and a half, and then I went in, then I got transferred into retirement planning and became a retirement planning consultant, which is one of my specialties. And then I started wholesaling. I became a product specialist in funds or whatever else. And then after 10 years, I got fired from Witter, which crushed me also because I'm a very loyal guy. And I went to another company here in Serafell, and I became a national sales manager for the next 10 years. I just had the time of my life. I was thin. I was successful. I was making a lot of money. I was in good spirits. I was healthy. I was in my 40s, 30s and 40s. I traveled all over the world. I went everywhere first class. I saw things and went to 49 states, and I mean, just had a great time. And then I got laid off from that in 1996, and ever since then, it's been a real struggle, because I turned 50. I don't know whether you've experienced, well, you're self-employed, so it doesn't matter. Turning 50 is a big, big change, being able to get a job. It's almost like being a veteran. You know, people just don't know how to hire you. So I've bounced around a little bit, but I've had good jobs, and I'm still doing fine, and, you know, I still have a good attitude, but that's basically been my life. I worked for GE Capital for 2 years and got let go from them because of 9/11. You know, I'm a national sales manager for GE Capital Long-Term Care Division right over here. I was there for a year. And then 9/11 happened, and then 2 weeks later, a memo came up and says, well, 9/11, we have to anticipate a real slowdown. We're laying off 5,000 people. I was one of them. You know, and then I worked for State Farm for 16 months, and they terminated the program, although that was a great program. I worked for a real estate company for 16 months out of Southern Cal, and probably because of my, I will admit this, because of my cancer and how that kind of changed all of my outlooks on life, and also because of my military experience, I have to admit, although I'm very accommodating as far as environment and all that, I have a problem with authority, especially if I don't respect it. And my last job I had, I hated the CEO. I thought he was an idiot. And I couldn't stand it, so I left. And that's probably because of you know, my, maybe I would have been that way, but my life experiences certainly taught me a certain amount of intolerance mm-hmm. for people I think are idiots. Mm-hmm.